Welcome to Board Game Binge, the place where we bring you bite-sized, bingeable board game content across the industry. I'm your host, James Staley, and in this episode, we're chatting with Dr. Helen McKay and Alex Nicholson from Sundog Studios. Sundog is debuting on Kickstarter Grassroots, a party game that challenges you to save the earth. Helen and Alex, welcome to the binge. How you doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is great to have you. I always love these interviews where I get to have like multiple guests on the different frames and things like this. It just gets me absolutely jazzed. So we're going to go through it. We've just met literally 30 seconds ago, so we don't really know each other, but we're going to get to know each other in this chat. First and foremost, Dr. Helen, can I just call you Helen? Do I have to call you Dr. Helen?
No, please call me Helen. Yeah.
So talk to us about your doctorate. So what is your doctorate in?
Yeah, so I'm a assistant professor of geography at a university in the UK, Durham University. And my research really focuses on long-term climate change. So my PhD was focusing on peatland environments and looking at how the climate's changed over the last few thousand years, because they preserve an amazing record of that. But also looking at how the carbon store changes, because that's obviously sort of big news in terms of thinking about CO2 in the atmosphere compared with kind of stored in our different reservoirs. But now a lot of my research actually looks at lake systems. So I'm really interested in basically reconstructing how climate's changed over thousands of years, so we get that really long-term perspective, and it kind of helps us understand what we're seeing today and also maybe how resilient our ecosystems are to some of the changes that we're seeing. A lot of my research actually focuses on looking at the links between humans, animals, and climate, and kind of how they're all interacting together.
Oh, that's cool. And then with this research, like, what is your ultimate goal of the research, or what is kind of the output, or how does it kind of serve the, for lack of a better statement, kind of global push to either, you know, stop or slow down human impacted or influenced climate change, or kind of what's the outcome?
Yeah, I suppose it's different for the different kind of projects that I'm working on, but I think maybe the kind of theme that kind of threads them all together is trying to find or really characterize that kind of baseline of how they've changed in the past, how sensitive they are to change, so that we can basically understand, well, maybe what are our priorities if we're thinking about conserving different ecosystems and environments, what are the most vulnerable, and maybe what can we actually do to try and help them kind of longer term. So a lot of the research I'm doing just now, or the kind of newest project, is looking in the Arctic and looking at reindeer populations. So the way in which kind of climate change is impacting their food source, so the vegetation and the reindeer just now, but taking it kind of long term to see, well, how have they coped in the past and what do we need to think about now?
It's crazy. Like when I'm a sucker for watching like a lot of these Netflix shows and things on National Geographic, but you know, just how fragile our ecosystem is, and how even removing like an animal from like one ecosystem can drastically impact it. And then how, and I think one of the examples was like the introduction of wolves here in, North America and some of the northern climates, and how that was able to bring back a lot of the ecosystem that was kind of lost, right? Like that, it shocks me. So might think, see like an animal of, oh, that's a ferocious animal, and you know, do we need them? But you know, them in the entire balance of that ecosystem probably play a pretty vital role, right?
Oh yeah, completely. And some of the work we've been looking at recently is actually in like archaeological populations to see how what impact really small scale communities have had on things like lakes, looking back maybe say 4,000 years ago, and actually they are having kind of impacts on the ecology of the lake and things like that. So you know, it's kind of helpful to kind of contextualize that, because obviously we are dealing with kind of big scale issues and pressures on the environment just now, but humans have actually been kind of tweaking it in different ways, you know, whether it is kind of thinking about different species and their interaction, or actual kind of physical activities of like clearing landscapes, you know, cutting down the forests, and the kind of knock-on effects that has. So yeah, I'm really lucky to kind of do this job because there's so many kind of fascinating areas that I can kind of dive into. I'm always learning stuff kind of as I go as well, so it's great.
How far back in the archaeology, like, do you go back to like 20,000 years ago, like, and how the environment was impacted by the megafauna and things like that, or like?
Yeah, you definitely can. So especially like some in places like Alaska, there's some really cool records. Yeah, looking on that time scale. A lot of my work actually focuses more on just the last 12,000 years because we've actually got like a lot of really good sort of archaeology that we can compare with our sediment records. And then as we get closer to the kind of modern day, we've got the historical archive. So I love trying to like kind of bring all these different streams together to try and really unpick like that whole picture.
Oh, it's amazing. And so Alex, I don't want to leave you kind of in the lurk here. So what's your role? How are you connected to Sundock?
I'm less impressive than Helen. So I work in the video games industry. I've been here for 6 or 7 years, I think. So I run a consultancy with my business partner who's in Newcastle with Helen and Dan. We mostly focus on publishing, so like self-publishing with developers or helping publishers have better experiences publishing their own games, and then kind of hiving off a bunch of it into like random business development and operational stuff for small studios. Anyone who's kind of like setting up a studio and doing something interesting, we want to talk to. And Helen and Dan and Holly were doing something interesting and starting something small. So I was like, I immediately wanted to get involved because navigating publishing a video game is hard, but navigating publishing a board game is much harder, I think.
Really?
But I
Really?
think everyone I've spoken to is like, why are you doing this? I'm like, why am I doing what? They're like, why are you trying to make a board game? It's so much more difficult than making video games. Like, I think the barrier to entry is a lot higher, and
Yeah, I think so. Because you have to physically send a good to someone, right? Versus just push it in an app or whatever and have people
I'm
download it.
used to just like printing keys and sending them to people via Steam, and it's a lot more complex when you have to like factor in
Yeah.
everything that comes with like a physical product. So yeah, like my background's video game publishing, and before that I was working in mental health research at universities, and I can't remember how, but I ended up in the video game industry instead, like 5 or 6 years ago. Genuinely can't remember how that happened.
It's a cool industry, right? From what I understand, there's a very and a lot of other publishers I've talked to who've come from the digital side. You know, there's kind of common themes, right? Where they say, you know, the process is very similar, right? Between video game development and board game development, you know, everything from, you know, setting up, you know, the base, you know, architecture of the game to bringing in artists and all this kind of stuff. But the development, again, from my understanding, the length of time to develop a video game is so much greater than, say, a board game, from many I've talked to. Is that the same for your experience or?
I mean, not for us. We took our time with it. I think for most people, it's just a case of it's harder to retroactively go and change the mechanics of a video game because you've effectively hard coded a lot of that.
Yeah.
And you know, we've done a fair share of killing our darlings at Sundog, and but everything that we had built was reusable because it's more conceptual, and a lot of the design stuff you can kind of reapply and redeploy into new games. Video games do kind of typically get wrapped up in like scope creep and bloating themselves into bigger, longer projects. But you can make video games, I'm not going to say easily because my whole industry will try and kill me, but like you can make them quickly and make interesting prototypes and full games in like in short cycles. But I
Yeah.
think the design architecture around tabletops versus digital is broadly similar, I think. I'm not a
Yeah.
design person, so if you get subtweeted by anyone, that's my fault.
Yeah. So Sundog is a relatively new company, though, I guess. Was it formed for this game specifically, or?
Yeah, so is that 21?
So we've been around for a few years, and we were starting to design a similar game but slightly different. So you might have noticed that our URL on Kickstarter is actually slightly different because it was the name of the old game, which was Eco Warriors. But we really created Sundogs because as we were developing that first game, we kind of were thinking a bit more carefully, or Alex really encouraged us to think about like what our more long-term vision was, and like really what we're all about is trying to like bring people together and like share that connection in games that are fun but also like quite enlightening and also eco-friendly. So they're our sort of like core principles, and yeah, that's why we wanted to start with this game but kind of think about in longer term as well and keep that kind of central to everything we're doing.
And then how many members is there of the company? Like the Sundog is made up of how many people?
Yeah, so there's four of us. So the other two, we have Dan, who he's a finance guy at a software company, but it was yeah, myself and Dan that kind of came up with the idea for the game and the kind of mechanics, and have put a lot of work into researching the content and developing it. But he also handles all the spreadsheets and that kind of side of things. And then we have Holly, who's our fantastic designer. So she's like done all the artwork and the cards and the design, and she's really interested in like UX stuff as well. She's actually gone back to uni to kind of learn more about that. So it's really nice to kind of have, yeah, her expertise in those different things as well.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, it's great when you have people that you can kind of bounce things off of, right? Like we often say on this podcast that the majority of this industry are companies of like one, one to three
Yeah.
people, right? So when you have people that you can kind of, you know, everyone that brings their own skill sets in, obviously, but being able to kind of bounce things off it as a group and kind of churn through ideas, you know, that collaborative part is really invaluable, I find. So how did you come up with this idea? Obviously, there's a tie in between what you're studying, right? And the theme of the game. But where, like, have you been personally gaming most of your life, or is this something that kind of like where'd this all come from?
Yeah, so yeah, we're big fans of all games really. And I think the timing of the company and the game design actually sort of coincided with COVID, because Dan and I all of a sudden had a lot of time together and we couldn't go to our sort of regular game night. So before that, you know, every week we were either hosting or going to friends for dinner, and then we'd always play different games, and that was like a kind of like core thing in our week that we always looked forward to. But and when that went, we thought, well, why don't we actually try and make a game? And yeah, both of us are just really into all things to do with nature. You know, like our favorite activities are just like going for walks and seeing new places, like seeing the kind of nature that's around. And of course, it ties in very closely to my day job. I think like for us, there's always, we're always just fascinated. You know, when you hear like a fact about something, you're like, oh, that's so cool, I had no idea. And that really is just what we were trying to bring in with this game, to kind of get it all in one place, I suppose, and share that kind of I suppose love for nature and like curiosity and kind of expanding, yeah, what we're kind of familiar with as well.
And then when did the first kind of prototype kind of come together? Like when was it during COVID, or when did you kind of have this first kind of, hey, we think we've got an idea here, let's turn this into to this kind of party game?
Yeah, it was during COVID, and it was like the previous version of the game, although the games are completely different, because Alex was very good at, as he said, making us kill our darlings when we had to. But yeah, we did a lot of like play testing during COVID just on online. So Holly had mocked up the version of the game like that way, and then we had some physical copies that Alex and I took to like play testing during that time. But yeah, it was, we were working hard on that kind of previous version of the game, but it was more sort of collecting sets, you know, trying to bring a bit of strategy as well as the trivia side of things. And as what we were kind of finding is at some point it actually didn't become that much fun anymore, because there was like so much knowledge that was required, and we just didn't want to have a game where you had to know the answers sort of thing. So that's why we kind of went back to the drawing board. I don't know, Alex, if you want to say something about that side of things.
Yeah, it was a really funny time. I remember it was like we went to a playtesting event in Croydon, and Croydon's like a small area south of London. So Helen and I took the game all fresh-faced, and we were like, it was one of the speed dating events where you go and play, you know, 10, 15 other people's games.
Yeah.
And it was a cool event set up by Playtest UK. And I just remember being like, oh wow, like our baby's ugly. And we should go and change this. Like I think part of it was it's not really a core board gamer type game, and it was lacking some of the strategy elements that you'd expect from, you know, everyone else was making Euro games, and we were like, we're straddling like strategy and trivia and not quite hitting either.
Yeah.
So we you know, it was a case of like, do we try and push this into something, or do we just try and crawl back and like redesign a lot of the stuff and try and make the mechanics a bit more sort of aligned with what we're trying to do? And that process is always really horrible, I think. But it's like it's better to do that before the game's out, right? Like that's the hard lesson.
Yeah, it's interesting when often I'll talk to people on their first game, and I went through the same thing where you go to these kind of speed dating, these prototyping events where you have often other game designers play your game, and you might think you have something that's all figured out, right, and great, and then someone breaks your game, right? Like they'll play it and they find like a fundamental thing that causes the game to kind of break or fail or not work. And you know, there's two ways to take that, right? One way is like, oh, this sucks, and oh man, I or the other aspect is, you know, thankfully this person found this before this was in the market, right? You know, thank you broke it. And there's actually groups now dedicated to getting people to try to break your game before you go to market, so that you can figure out, you know, all these issues and iron out all the wrinkles, find out if it's, you know, the fundamental question, is it fun, right? There's so many times people will present a game and, you know, I'll often have that if I'm at a prototyping event where I you know, I have one of our games that we're testing, you know, and I always find this challenge with game designers specifically, because they jump right in. You need to fix this, and this, and oh, this wasn't quite working, and this reminds me of this. And I'm like, whoa, 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 whoa. Was it fun? First and foremost, just tell me, because it wasn't fun, we don't even need to get into the other stuff, or maybe we can dive deeper, but you know, that's
That's
the
the
first
thing.
question I gotta answer.
Like I spent the last few years working on the scouting team at an indie publisher, so doing digital games. But the first question is always like, is this game fun? And if it's not fun, like the line of questioning you have to take with the developer is a long one. And like oftentimes there isn't a resolution to that. And you know, if it isn't fun, it isn't going to be commercial probably. And at the end of the day, like there's a huge space for like making art stuff that isn't super commercial, and that's great. And there's tons of people doing it in a really great way. But like, in order to make a business, we just couldn't do that. So it was like, let's go back, let's revisit things, and kind of redo, I think, literally everything. So that was like 2022, I think. But the game's a thousand times better because of that, I think.
And then how long did it take? Like, because anytime, and I mean, I don't know if I'll ever tackle like a trivia type party game, just because it scares the heck out of me, just the sheer amount of questions that you're gonna have to come up with. Like, you have to have a lot, right? And I don't know how many are in your game, how many questions you have or facts.
We've got upwards of 150 questions.
Yeah, like
So
that's a
yeah.
lot
So.
of, it's not even the questions, it's what haunts me, and I have trouble sleeping at night sometimes, is when you run into what's called being copy blind, right? Where eight people read the same piece of copy and they sign off saying it's good, and lo and behold, someone else gets in their hand, they're like, oh, what about these six typos? And it's like, what? And I just ran into this again last week on one of my games that we're getting ready for print. And it was my translator that found the issue. So someone in another language was looking at the English, and they're like, okay, your translation is ready, but you know, I noticed these six things that aren't kind of jiving on the English side. I just want to make sure that these are correct. I'm like, wow, eight people signed off on that, and it took you to find this. And I think sometimes you have to take yourself out of it, right, to be able to catch these things. But that's what scares me the most with these kinds of games. So kudos to you guys for having the bravery to 150 questions and facts. That's incredible. So let's talk about this. I'm going to share on screen for people that want to follow along, if they're either on the replay or they're watching. We got a lot of people watching live right now as well. But talk to us about Grassroots. So this is a smaller game. It's your first game as a publisher. For me, when I first started reading through it and the videos, it gave me very much almost like a combination of a little bit of like Chits and Wagers, like for the kind of get to the closest number and the facts, plus taking like maybe some charades, plus taking some like Trivial Pursuit. Like there's kind of like a combo of these different types of party game styles you've kind of all put into one. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, definitely. We wanted to create the different challenge types so that there is something for everyone, really. Especially, like we were saying, one of the big things is trying to get people together. And we wanted it to sort of work well for kind of groups of friends as a party game, but also kind of family as well. So, yeah, we've got a bit of everything there. So, like you said, we've got the sort of act cards where you have to kind of act out the word on the card. That's particularly popular with the younger players.
Yeah.
They really like to do that. We've also got describe, so you can describe the term in less than 5 words. And they are really good because, again, you don't actually have to be familiar with the term necessarily. You just have to kind of maybe think along different lines to try and get there, and also think about how your team might be thinking. So, this isn't a strategy game, but you can kind of start to think a bit sort of critically, I suppose, in that sense. We also have the kind of guess cards, like you say, so we have to like get closest to the number. And these questions are things that you probably won't know the answer to. So, like, what's the kind of the distance for a whale migration, for example? But we hope that especially these ones, they often get people kind of thinking, like, I had no idea. Like, that's super cool. In terms of the kind of what nature is actually doing. And then, yeah, we have the list ones where you get a category and you have to list as many as you can, but you can kind of battle against the different teams to try and kind of like up one another in terms of how many you think you can achieve. So, yeah, we've got those different categories that kind of all come together, and it's like a race to kind of win the different categories. Yeah, Alex, I think you were kind of
Yeah,
involved.
there's what was interesting for us was like we when we started Eco Warriors, we like I said, we were like in two different camps, and we spent a bit of time thinking about like, what are the things that we like about board games? And in my head, I'm like, I play Pax Pamir, I play Twilight Struggle, I'm like a cerebral board game guy. And it's like, oh wait, actually no, I actually just play Poetry for Neanderthals. I really like playing the game in the car when you list stuff. Like all the stuff you did as a kid, like all the games you played, are like the most fun games because they're just so easily digestible and like super accessible. So for us, it was a case of like taking all the stuff that just people know and they get and they understand and they have fun with, and you can like imagine a family playing this around a table, and that's kind of how we pushed everything together and like managed to keep it within the one camp of like it being a party game without trying to like feature creep into, oh, there's a strategic layer and there's point winning. It's like, no, let's pull back. Let's just do stuff that's widely accepted as being really fun and make a fun game.
Yeah, it's, I mean, not even in a house, but I can imagine like at like summer camping, right?
Yeah.
And around the campfire playing a game like this. Or if people have cabins, going to the cabins or their trailers or whatever they do in the summertime. This seems like it's a really kind of fun kind of social thing that you can kind of sink your teeth in, especially if you're in a nature environment. I think would be kind of cool too. Okay, so can you describe through kind of the essence of how to play this game? So there's you've got your kind of 4 categories, I guess, right?
Yeah, definitely. So it's a team game. So basically each team will get a set of 6 cards, and they are basically kind of depicting the Earth. So the kind of cards come together to make that globe. The game starts with these cards where Earth isn't looking too happy. We've got kind of oceans with like rubbish in them. We've got kind of croplands that are looking bad. And the aim of the game is to win these challenge cards, to flip the Earth cards so that they're back to like the kind of thriving environment. So that's the kind of idea of trying to fix or save Earth's kind of ecosystems. So they just take it in turns drawing cards, and you'll get kind of one of these categories that we've already described. And then if you win the card, you can turn over one of your Earth cards. And in the game as well, we've got sort of event cards. So they might kind of either help you and your team, or maybe kind of set you back a pace. We've also actually included some cards that are, I suppose, well, not quite wild cards, but they're actually just left blank, because what we found with people is they, when they were playing it, they had an aspect of like nature or the environment that they just loved and they wanted in this game. So it was sort of to try and like give back some of that kind of like influence that you can add in to like make the game your own.
Oh, that's cool. So just so I'm clear on the event, so how does the event kind of come up? So they're drawing a new card from the deck, and an event
Yeah.
card could come up randomly, I guess, as part of that.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And then how does that impact the gameplay? Like, what does the event do to the players?
Yeah, so when you get an event card, you can it either gives you the power to flip one of your Earth cards, so you don't have to win that extra challenge,
Oh,
or
okay.
you can like kind of negatively impact the other team as well. So you can like make them answer kind of another card to get to those six right answers.
Oh, that's amazing. And I noticed that your timelines are pretty aggressive. So you guys are planning on delivering this by the end of this year as well, right?
Yeah, we have the game made. So in terms of yeah, we've got all the kind of challenge cards together. We've like fact checked everything. We have proofread it many times, but as you said, we'll do another check of that. And we've got the kind of design work together. So really, it's just a case of like kind of pulling everything together at the end. We've got like options for the manufacturers and the distributors. So you know, everything actually looks quite achievable in the time frame. That does give us some slack based on the estimates that they were giving us as well. So I think it's just because we're in that position that we're ready to go if it's
Oh, that's
planned.
awesome.
Plus the benefit of like having kind of done the dance once with the previous game was we were having these manufacturing discussions before we canceled the other game, so like we just carried them on. So like we're kind of a little bit further ahead than we should be, just purely by accident, which is quite nice.
Yeah, once you've gone through the dance once with the manufacturers, it's you learn a lot, but it's a pretty
Yeah.
formulaic after that, right? Like it's almost paint by numbers, I would say. So what, like, as a company then, so after this game is kind of published and you've done this game, like, do you have other things in the pipe you've planned, or kind of where do you go from here? Like, what do you guys got planned?
So I think the original theory of what we were going to do is Helen, Dan and Holly really wanted to work on kind of a bigger style game, probably in the style of something like Viticulture. And I think that's still in the cards and it's something we'd like to do, but I think the way this is purely taking my experience from a different industry, but I think being creative and trying a bunch of different smaller things that are feasible before you scope up is really important, so you don't trip yourself up. Like I see a lot of developers in my space kind of making their magnum opus now and working on a 5-year project before they've learned how to, do the manufacturing conversations and do all the other stuff that's just totally essential to running a business. So for us, it's like we'd like to do more grassroots stuff, I think. We did have some versions of Eco Warriors that were kind of we could reskin in different ways and different aesthetics, but I'm not sure if we can do that for grassroots in the same way. But I think more small, interesting prototypes that you find the fun in really quickly and just build like something around that that's a foundational piece that allows us to then kind of go and spend time working on a bigger game that is, less feasible and more difficult to make.
It makes sense. My first five Kickstarters were all small, right? And like just incremental steps up and applying the learning from the prior one to get to the next one, to the next one. And we had in the pipeline this big game, this game called Cities of Venus that we did a year and a half ago, which was a huge campaign. It was our biggest campaign we'd ever done. It was big, and but it took a lot of investment. There was a lot of kind of a lot more at risk with a game like that. And we could have launched it, a couple of years earlier than we did, but we really wanted to understand really the fundamental building blocks of not only putting together a Kickstarter campaign, but then the fulfillment, the manufacturing, things like add-ons and all that. Like we wanted to really understand all of that before we sunk our teeth into that larger campaign. And thankfully we did. Because we were way more informed going into that and still made some decisions that I would probably do differently next time. So I chalked those up as learnings. And learnings usually cost money, but that's okay. But it's these things that you have this cumulative knowledge that you continue to build. So I can totally appreciate that mindset. It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and the parameters that you put on yourself make you better at design. Like they make you better at business as well, but I think we're better at designing games because we've given ourselves a scope that's really small and we've given ourselves parameters to work within rather than being able to kind of do the whole creep out into making this huge game.
Yeah.
Like I take a lot of like inspiration from like, do you know Button Shy? the so like Buttonshy and Big Potato and people like that who are like just making lots of cool, interesting, fun things that are never like bloated. And that's kind of our goal for right now, and then we can figure it out later.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, for those who want to check out this campaign, they can go on Kickstarter. They can type in grassroots. You'll take it right to the campaign page. I'm also going to put a link in the show notes, both on the Facebook page. So if people aren't part of our Facebook group yet, look up Board Game Binge Podcast on Facebook. It's a private group. Join it, and you get to see replays of these interviews, as well as be able to interact with some of the guests that we've had on the show. But I'm going to put links there as well as in the audio. If people listen to the audio, if you're listening on Apple or Spotify, there'll be a link in the show notes there as well. Check it out. Grassroots, Dr. Helen and Alex, I want to wish you all the best in this campaign this coming year. And I can't wait to see how this turns out for you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so
It's just been
much.
great to chat.
All right, guys, you take care. Cheers.
Cheers.
This has been an episode of the Board Game Binge Podcast, hosted by James Staley, produced by James Staley and Mike Bruner, with original music by Nick Smith. If you would like to watch these interviews live, simply subscribe to our YouTube channel, Board Game Binge, and you'll get access to live interviews, giveaways, and interesting board game content from across the industry. I can't wait for you to join us. See you next time.